If you have ever been to one of the great sporting events in our country, perhaps at Wembley Stadium, or at QPR, or at Wimbledon, you are aware that the stadium is something like a shrine, a temple. When you get to the temple, the shrine, the stadium, you're aware that you haven't really got to the inner sanctum. But there is an inner sanctum. It might be the director's room at the football stadium. It might be the referee's office at Wimbledon. Alternatively, it might be the commentary box. I have been in the commentary box at Wimbledon, not just on a tour of the premises, but actually during a match, during the championships. To get in there is very difficult. You've got to get past guards. You cannot get by without some special kind of pass. But I have been into that inner sanctum of the commentary box with the genial Fred Perry smoking his pipe there, Max Robertson present. He turned to me and he'd say, "Well, how do you feel about the form of Jimmy Connors today?" I'd say, "Well, he's hitting him very well, isn't he?" And I think, what a privilege it is to get into this place. How did I get into it? Because I had a friend. I had a tennis friend who got me in. He said, "You come along with me." He didn't even wave the pass at the guards. He just took me in. They said, "Fine, come through." And I walked in with him. In a few seconds, I was inside the inner sanctum. We're talking a little bit about that in our sermon. Jesus, the way to the throne. We're looking at Hebrews chapter 4. Verse 14 onwards. It's on page 205, wasn't it, in the church Bibles. 205, I think that's right. Have a look at it, would you? Jesus, the way to the throne, to the power center, to the inner sanctum. That's what we're thinking a bit about this morning, and it's very important. I'll read those first two sentences. Verse 14. Hebrews 4. "Since then we have a great high priest who has passed through the heavens, Jesus, the Son of God. Let us hold fast our confession, for we have not a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. Let us then with confidence draw near to the throne of grace, that we may receive mercy and find grace to help in time of need." And the reading goes on, as we had in our second reading, on to chapter 5 and verse 10. Jesus is the final word. That's the title of our series. And today, Jesus is the way to the throne, to that inner sanctum, where nobody else can get except through him. As we come to these verses, we're leaving the first great section of the letter to the Hebrews, and we're entering the next. This next section, which begins here at verse 14 and ends several chapters later at chapter 10, verse 18, got a long stretch here, takes up now the central theme of the nature of the high priesthood of Jesus Christ, though there's one break which next week's study is going to cover. But that's what we're now about to cover, the nature of Christ's, what do we call it? High priesthood. When we're trying to get into that inner sanctum, we need the intermediary. We need somebody who says, "I will conduct you there. Come with me." That's what we're talking about. The necessary intermediary to get you to the places which otherwise you cannot get to. So, verse 14, "since then." It's a summary phrase as we come to the end of the opening great section of the letter. And all those main points that have been made earlier are brought together now in verses 14 to 16. A great high priest, verse 14. The writer had already opened up this theme in chapter 2, verse 17, and also in chapter 3, verse 1. "Therefore, holy brethren, who share in a heavenly call, consider Jesus the apostle and high priest of our confession." A great high priest. Christ passing through the heavens, verse 14. You see the phrase? Keep your eyes on the text. Passing through the heavens. Well, that expression has already been made in chapter 1, verses 3 and 4, and verse 13 of chapter 1. Or in chapter 2, verse 9, where his exaltation is referred to. He's picking up the threads here. Then looking again at verse 14 of chapter 4. His divine sonship, Jesus the Son of God. That's already been communicated to us in the whole of chapter 1, and again we see it in chapter 3 and verse 6. But Christ was faithful over God's house as a son. His sympathy with us in our weaknesses, verse 14. That's already been stated in chapter 2, for example, in verse 17, which speaks of him being, quote, like his brethren in every respect, so that he might become a merciful and faithful high priest. Already, you see, as this amazing epistle develops, some tremendous confidences have been built up in the superiority of Jesus Christ over any and every previous arrangement for dealing with the frailties and needs of men and women. He's superior to the angels, chapter 1 and 2. He's superior to Moses, we've already been told. Great as Moses was, that's referred to in chapter 3. Both those twin principles of superiority arising out of the foundation principle of Jesus Christ as the unique Son of God. That's the center. So we're moving now into the theme of the superior priesthood of Christ. He's a better intermediary to get us into those inaccessible places, better than anybody else. That's what we're thinking about. In society, across the ages, wherever people have built themselves places to live in, they've also set up some form of worship shrine. Temples, pagodas, wigwams, whatever it might be. And then society has set apart one of its own membership to minister on its behalf, to intercede, to bless, to search for ways of forgiveness, in short, to act as a priest, as that elusive intermediary that everybody is looking for. So as far as the people of Israel were concerned, the sons of Aaron, Moses' brother, they were to be the priests. We read about them in Exodus 28. So they lived apart, they wore recognizably different clothes, they even ate differently as they looked after the spiritual welfare of Israel. And then century after century passed, 16 centuries or thereabouts. And then the faith of Christ made its arrival. And little by little, as the worship at the Temple of Jerusalem began to sag and even became threatened, especially as the Romans flattened the city of Jerusalem in AD 70, this epistle was written in the early 60s. It began to emerge, as people began to read through the epistle to the Hebrews, began to emerge that a new priesthood had superseded the old one. A priesthood centering in one individual, Jesus. So let us try then to visualize the extremity of this priestly ministry. What I call the extremity of his priestly ministry. As we look at these verses, 14 to 16, would you look at them again? We can see immediately that it covers from one extremity to the other. He plumbs the depth, but he also ascends to the heights. Notice the phrase in verse 14 that Christ has passed through the heavens. Not simply into the heavens, that is fine, but through the heavens, moving from our visible world here, through the heavens, and into the highest and most inaccessible center of all, the very inner shrine of God's presence. There are so many illustrations of that. You must know some in your own experience. I remember once dining with an admiral, one of the top admirals of the British fleet. And I thought, I'd better get myself ready for this. This is going to be important, turning up at Admiralty House. Unfortunately, I had a very busy day. And I hadn't quite got time to wash my car beforehand. I did put on a blue pinstripe suit. Then I thought, now I must wash the car. I hadn't got time. So I arrived at Admiralty House in this grubby old, clapped-out Ford Cortina estate in my shiny suit. And as the car arrived on the crunchy gravel outside the house, A man in uniform stepped forward to open the door of my grubby little car and then saluted me like that. I got out. I was then escorted to the front door of Admiralty House, where there was a man standing beside a cannon. He saluted me as I arrived at the door. Left the car on the gravel. I got inside there, and there was a security man next. I was allowed through because I had a piece of paper letting me through. Then the next man took my order for the drink. And then finally I got into the Admiral. It was quite an experience. How did I get in there through those security and the guards and the cannon and so on? I had a piece of paper that got me in there. I needed the intermediary, the introduction into the presence. Now Christ, we learn from Scripture, is the perfect one to conduct us into the presence. This is very practical for us who feel buffeted and overwhelmed by some of the problems that converge upon our own lives day by day. We may feel grubby, you see. We may feel unworthy and plagued by human failure and temptation, but look at verse 15. May we read it? For we have not a high priest who is unable to sympathize with our weaknesses, but one who in every respect has been tempted as we are, yet without sin. So let us therefore with confidence draw near to the throne, to the presence. We're reminded here that he's been ahead of us. He's there in the presence itself on our behalf. He's passed through the heavens. And the incredible thing is, he is one of us. The extremities are covered in this ministry of Christ. He is divine, verse 14, he is the great high priest, summary of all that we've been reading about before, the great high priest, divine. He is human. He's been tempted, just as we are, we're told in verse 15. In every respect he's been tempted, going through the difficulties that we encounter, but more so. You see, we give up at a certain point of temptation. We succumb. Christ has gone through to the very extremity, the full difficulty and adversity of temptation. He has met and conquered. He's gone through the whole thing, yet without sin. He is one of us. He's been to the depths and knows how strong temptation and adversity can be. But then he's passed through the heavens into the presence. He's exalted to the very highest place of all. But he's also lived here on earth. He's been hungry and thirsty and tired. He knows what it's like and he can sympathize. He knows the height and he knows the depth. So we visualize the extremity of his priestly ministry. There's nothing like it. There's no situation about which Jesus has to say, "Oh, I didn't know about that in your life. Oh, I wouldn't know what that kind of pressure would be, I'm afraid. I haven't, you know, experienced that." He has experienced the full pressures that we experience and more. He is therefore a great intermediary, a great high priest to conduct us into the inner sanctum, the presence. So there are two great encouragements for us in these opening verses. Verse 14, let us hold fast our confession, not slip. That was the problem of these Hebrew Christians. They were losing their sight of the uniqueness of the Christian revelation centering in Christ. They were in danger of slipping back to the old ways. So the writer says to them, hold fast. Don't let it go. Look at the encouragements. And verse 16, draw near. Those two great encouragements. Hold fast what you've already embraced and now draw near to that inner sanctum, to the throne. Grubby, disheveled, ashamed as you may feel, and unprepared to come into the presence, you can come because of Christ, we're told. We can draw near to that throne, to that center. There are times in life when we need a higher court of appeal. You've perhaps put in an appeal for something that you're trying to obtain. Some of you people from overseas are perhaps having difficulties in this country. We understand. Sometimes you have to go to some court to get it sorted out. Maybe your appeal fails, so then you try a higher court. Maybe some of you are in this exact moment facing a real difficulty about something that's got to happen in your life, and it doesn't seem to be happening. And you've tried some sort of court of appeal. That's the right thing to do. But there is a highest court of all. It is the throne of God, where His sovereignty exerts its sway, and nobody will gainsay it. We may come to that throne secretly, in our bedrooms, on our knees, in the private recesses of our lives. We may come, through Jesus Christ, our intermediary, into that highest court of all, and say, He pleads my case for me. I ask Him to support my case before the inner sanctum, in the immediate presence. And we can do it with confidence, we're told, because He is a great high priest. Visualize the extremity of His ministry. He's lived among us and plumbed the depths, but He's also exalted into the heights, passed through the heavens. Visualize the extremity. Secondly, there's a similarity as well. Analyze the similarity in His ministry here. We're moving on to chapter 5, verse 1 to 5. The similarity, that is to say, to the preceding priesthood that Christ came to supersede. Keep your eyes now on these opening verses of chapter 5, would you? See how grateful we who are Gentile Christians are for our Jewish friends. It's from them that we've received most of what we understand by priesthood. In Israel of old, there was this divine requirement for an intermediary. And we can see here in chapter 5, verses 1 to 5, a parallel between the priesthood of Aaron, about which we read in Exodus 28, and Christ's perfect and eternal priesthood. If there's going to be an intermediary, several things have got to happen, we learn from these sentences. One, the priest must be, verse 1, chosen from among men. He's got to be one of you. Must be one of us. And Christ was that, knowing what it was to be hungry, to be under pressure, knowing what it was to taste life as it is on this fallen world. It is a fallen world. Life here is difficult as well as exciting. And at times we feel the difficulties more than at other times. Christ knew that. He was chosen from among men. He is and was a man. One of us. Second, the priest must act on behalf of the people. Second half of verse 1, in relation to God, to offer gifts and sacrifices for sins. So he's representing the people to God, bringing sacrifices on their behalf. Christ has done that uniquely, supremely. We shall see it spelt out more and more as this wonderful letter to the Hebrews unfolds. The uniqueness of Christ's one-off, never-to-be-repeated sacrifice. He has done it. The priest must act. Three, he must be one who can act with compassion. Verse 2, dealing, quote, gently with the ignorant and wayward. And how accommodating Christ was, without ever being weak. He could understand just what it was that going through a man or woman's mind. He could see what it was that was troubling them. He could bring in that helping hand. Sometimes the hand of correction, but so often the hand of gentleness and strength and love, compassion, mercy. He must be one who can act with compassion. Four, the priest is not self-appointed. You see that in verse 4? But he must be appointed by God. And again, the quote there, we've had it earlier in the Epistle to the Hebrews, from Psalm 2, verse 7, which emphasizes Christ's eternal sonship. He's appointed by God. And there comes the quote to back it up. Now Christ is our great intermediary, parallels the ministry of Aaron's priesthood. That's what we're learning here. This is to be an encouragement to those Jewish Christians of 60 AD plus, and as the letter to the Hebrews became circulated, as the collapse of Jerusalem took place, as the temple of Jerusalem was annihilated, It's possible, you see, at that point, you might have had a developing Jewish Christianity and a developing Gentile Christianity split. It was not to be. The old system was about to be changed, and there's no need, the letter to the Hebrews is saying, no need to begin a new system of priests and sacrifices. Because here is one priestly mediating figure who has, through the cross, resurrection and ascension, set up and made available an everlasting Aaronic-like priesthood who can care for us all. So there's an analysis here of the similarities. He must be one of us, act on our behalf, be compassionate, and be God-appointed. There are no more sacrificing priests. There's only one now. I am not a priest as I stand here in this pulpit. And if sometimes the prayer book of the Church of England refers to clergymen as the priest, it's only in terms of the translation from the Latin, presbyter, elder, not as a sacrificing priest. We must understand that very clearly. We don't have to get to God through a priest today, because Jesus Christ is the one and only intermediary who will guarantee us entry and a safe conduct and supporting our case at the centre. You don't have to go through a clergyman and say, would you intercede to God on my behalf? Because you're so powerful, you'll get through to the presence better than I can. You can do it for yourself. And in that sense, we are all priests, in a minor sense, coming through Jesus Christ, the great high priest. Each of us. You could do it today. Coming into the inner sanctum, by Jesus, he's the only way, but he will conduct you. So we visualize the extremity of his ministry, and we have analyzed a little bit the similarity of it to Aaron's priesthood. Thirdly, we recognize the superiority of it. We recognize the superiority of it. Look on at verses 6 to 10. Suddenly, Melchizedek is mentioned. He'll get mentioned later, of course, in chapter 7. But he's mentioned, he just gets a mention here. Thou art a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. He's not been mentioned before. And then the referral to Christ's offering up of prayers and supplications with loud cries and tears, and how it was that he became qualified to be a priest after the order of Melchizedek. Who is this Melchizedek? You probably know about him if you read Genesis. It's a reference here to the shadowy figure of Melchizedek, the priest who is also a king, who features in Genesis chapter 14. So immediately now, there's a contrast drawn. There was a similarity to the Aaronic priesthood, and there were many similarities there. But the parallel has to stop at a certain point. In many ways, Christ's priesthood is to be seen as a parallel to Melchizedek's, a priest who is a kind of one-off, unique priest. He comes onto the stage of Genesis without any introduction whatever. We know nothing of his birth, parentage, death, or genealogy. Melchizedek is a timeless figure of the Old Testament. And so the writer is drawing a parallel between Christ and Melchizedek. We'll see this more fully developed when we come on to chapter 7. But he gets a mention here. And it's a reminder to us that Christ's priesthood is outside of Aaron's priesthood. It's like it, but it's outside it. It's independent of it. It has, in fact, superseded Aaron's priesthood. And as we look at the remaining sentences of our study, we can see how Christ was preeminently qualified for such an intermediary role. He became a priest, we read there. Do you see that? Being designated by God a high priest, he became the source of eternal salvation. He became a priest. How is that done? Not easily. You don't simply step into the role and say, oh, I'll be the priest then. First you are chosen, and then you are prepared. How is he prepared? It was not an easy path. The prayers, verse 7, the supplications, the loud cries and tears to him who was able to save him from death, and he was heard for his godly fear. Not easy. We think of Gethsemane, where Christ prayed and wept and suffered in anticipation of the anguish that was to come. It was not easy, but all of his life was that, resisting of the power of evil and the standing against it in the power of God. He became a priest. Not easy. And then obedience, verse 8, that is part of it. Although he was a son, he learned obedience through what he suffered. Obedience, how is that quality developed? Not easily, but through suffering and hardship and pain and determination. And then verse 9, being made perfect, he became the source of eternal salvation. Perfect? How does that happen? How is such a state achieved? Not easily. We're not talking here about moral perfection, because Christ had that from the very beginning. We're talking about fitness, qualification. How is it that he became a qualified, fit priest on our behalf? Not easily. But by it, he has purchased for us a source of eternal salvation, verse 9. So we see how he is the timeless high priest, superseding all other ways and approaches to God. We've visualized the extremity. We've analyzed a little bit the similarity, but we recognize the superiority of Jesus Christ over these other systems. You see, we might have thought, couldn't it have happened another way? If we'd tried to dream it up ourselves, we might have said, look, God can come among his subjects like King Henry V, disguising himself and wandering about among his subjects in disguise. But no, he became one of us, suffering, weeping, enduring. That is the way of strength, it seems. That is the way of perfection. That is the way of obedience and becoming a priest after the order, it says, of Melchizedek, the one-off priest who has no real parallel at all. We visualize the extremity. We analyze the similarity. We recognize the superiority of Christ in his intermediary role. Are you struggling here, somebody, with some intractable problem that needs to be brought to the very inner center court sanctum, that board of directors room at the stadium, that judge's high court? Well, there's one way you can get there, only one. You come via Jesus Christ. He'll support your case. If you are one of those who is described here, and perhaps you are one, verse 9, the source of eternal salvation to all who obey him. If you're putting him first in your life, if you've entrusted him, your life to him, and belong to him, and are seeking to obey him, you have every qualification to say, be my intermediary, be my go-between, conduct me into the presence, support my case at the power center and at the throne. We'll do that today.